Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Ian Hancock makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here on quite a few occasions, and I'll introduce him very briefly on this occasion to talk about his recently released book, Ainslie Gatto, which has just come out, and we're delighted to have Ian here. Up from Canberra. Now, very briefly, introduce him. He's written a couple of books on the Liberal Party. He's written many articles, chapters. He's written entries in the Australian Dictionary of Biography. But he's also done, on my count, 5 biographies on, most recently, Tom Hughes, on John Gorton, on Jim Plimsoll, and Nick Greiner.
Not Plimsoll, sorry.
I think so.
Okay.
I've worked it out.
Well, he should have written one on Jim Plimsoll. And of course, now Ainslie Gatto. And so the topic for tonight's talk is Ainslie Gatto working with John Gorton. Ian, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Joe. I hope if you can't hear me, please say something. I don't know.
We might just pull that up. Okay.
In February 1968, John Gorton, who was the new Prime Minister of Australia, overrode 2 very senior public service mandarins and insisted that Ainslie Gatto should be his principal private secretary, his PPS. Ainslie had just turned 22 years of age. For the next 3 years, he occupied what one journalist described as the front seat the nation's most strategic administrative post. In February 2006, a party was held at Royal Sydney Golf Club to celebrate Ainslie's 60th birthday. Race Matthews, a former lover, Gough Whitlam's PPS when Ainslie was John Gorton's PPS, and later a minister himself in the Kayne Labor government in Victoria, was one of 2 main speakers. He said that Ainslie, and I quote, had punctured, albeit sadly failed to shatter, the glass ceiling of the day. Ainslie most certainly did pierce the ceiling well before its survival was severely challenged, though she did so while remaining almost willfully oblivious of its existence. She turned her back on the women's liberation movement and disavowed any role as a trailblazer. Nevertheless, she did register 2 firsts in what had been and remained for some time an exclusively male world. She was the first female PPS and the first female political staffer of an Australian Prime Minister. But at first glance, her sole qualification to be a PPS was that she could type. How then did she get a job? Ainslie's education had been disrupted because her father, rising to seniority as an RAF officer, had shifted between states and countries, disrupting her schooling. Despite failing in maths and science, Ainslie obtained a Victorian Intermediate Certificate, though as a teenager it seemed more likely that she would find a career in ballet or in the theatre. Her father suggested she might take a secretarial course. He regarded ballet as a big risk, and the reason's not the most one that would obviously spring to mind. He pointed out that the Gatto bones were notoriously fragile. It was good advice. Ainslie has broke 6 ankles in her lifetime. At least she had good connections, she had determination, and she had impeccable timing. An uncle by marriage happened to have been a PPS for Bob Menzies. he was probably influential in Canberra's small world in 1964 for her move out of the immigration typing pool to be a secretary to a very senior public servant in the Prime Minister's department. She was there in 1966 when Bill Aston, then the Liberal Party's chief whip, needed to make several phone calls to persuade a very reluctant Ainslie, who said she loathed politicians, to take a secondment as a clerical assistant in the whip's office. Timing now took its turn. Aston was elected Speaker in the new Parliament after Harold Holt won his landslide election in 1966, and the Prime Minister appointed Dudley Irwin, his deputy whip, to replace him. Dudley was a very decent man, but not overly bright. Jim Killen, the new deputy whip, was certainly bright, but he had no enthusiasm for the post. He thought Holt gave him the job to muzzle a noisy right-wing maverick. Killen would then send telegrams to the whip's office from his base in Brisbane saying he was coming, omitting to add a date or a time. Ainslie seized the opportunity to take command of the whip's office when Irwin was in the house. Sitting alone in the whip's office, she recorded and dealt with backbench concerns and problems. Backbenchers often approached her first about speaking on legislation or came by just for good company. Ainslie ensured that the ministers were ready to take their turn at the table during debates, that MPs were available for debates and divisions, and that pairs were arranged with the gentlemanly Gil Duthie, the opposition whip. Ainslie did not have the authority to make decisions, but she could assess the situations and advise. And she was not afraid to confront the recalcitrant. Standing just shy of 5'3" tall, her father, I might say, was only just half a centimetre taller, Ainslie became known during 1967 as the mini-whip. Importantly, throughout a long day in Parliament, her keen and alert mind was absorbing information and learning about political and personal likes and dislikes. In the process, she made lifelong friends with many Liberals, including Don Chipp, Andrew Peacock, Tom Hughes, Gordon Freeth, Billy Snedden, and the irrepressible Killen. She also established a lifelong loathing of McMahon and of Fraser. If Irwin's promotion to chief whip and Killen's many absences had given her greater notability, three occurrences, the damning VIP affair, the death of Harold Holt, and Gordon's pitch for the leadership, would thrust her into the centre of Liberal Party politics. Towards the end of 1967, the government was suffering from self-inflicted wounds emanating from Holt's determination not to release details of the use of the VIP flights. With the collusion of Sir John Bunting, the Secretary of the Prime Minister's Department, and Peter Howson, the Minister for Air, Holt claimed that records of VIP flights were not kept for long, and that there were no available records of flight destinations or of passengers carried. On the 24th of October 1967, with pressure coming to a head in the Senate, Sid Gotto rang his daughter to say that flight authorisation books were kept permanently and passenger manifests were retained for 12 months. That's the first time he'd spoken to Ainslie for 4 years. Armed with this information, Irwin took Ainslie to meet John Gorton, the new leader of the government in the Senate. At a stroke, Gorton defused the issue and became a hero within the Liberal Party for rescuing the government. Without his intervention in the VIP affair, it is inconceivable that he would have become Prime Minister of Australia, possibly because not many people in the party had actually heard of him. Ainslie's information had another outcome. Gorton had received solid evidence that Bunting and Howson had misled Holt and thereby damaged him politically. When he became Prime Minister, Gorton sidelined the former and dumped the latter. Gorton was now a frequent visitor to the whip's office and especially enjoyed talking to a smart and attractive young woman who liked to speak her mind. Ainslie, in turn, shared Irwin's view that Gorton was like a breath of fresh air. She was captivated by his fervent nationalism and his visions of a country being proud of itself and united in purpose. The Senate election of 25 November delivered a sharp rebuff to the Holt government. This result increased the chatter about Holt's eventual successor, first prompted in mid-1967, when Irwin and Gotto witnessed Holt's sudden stagger in the whip's office. It wasn't a heart attack, but that's what they first thought. At some point in early 1967, Ainslie recorded her conversation with Alan Fairhall, the Minister for Defence, fifth in seniority in the government, in the cabinet. The record reads like a conversation between equal and hard-headed politicos. They discussed strategies for dealing with Holt's loss of strategy, loss of popularity, and his failure to master Gough Whitlam, the leader of the opposition. Ainslie offered sound advice to Fairhall on how to proceed and collected information, and she at the same time collected some valuable inside information, not least learning that Fairhall had no desire to see McMahon ever leading the Liberal Party. Ainslie heard on the radio about midday on Sunday the 17th of December that a prominent person was missing at Portsea. She immediately concluded that Holt was the unnamed individual and was almost certainly dead. She rang Irwin, remember she's the clerical assistant and he's the chief whip, rang him at his home in Ballarat and told him to come to Canberra immediately and at the same time to contact John McEwen, the leader of the National Country Party, to make sure he did as well. Ainslie had two very clear objectives. First, she wanted to ensure that McMahon, the deputy leader of the Liberals, did not secure his election as leader by persuading Irwin, she wanted to persuade Irwin, and others to persuade Irwin as well, to call a party room meeting within the next few days. She wanted to gather the anti-McMahon forces and was unaware at the time of McEwen's plans to blackball the deputy Liberal leader. That was her first objective. The second one was to make sure that Gorton succeeded Harold Holt. And after Irwin reached Canberra on that Sunday afternoon, the three of them went to Gorton's home, where they made lists of possible Gorton supporters and opponents in the cabinet and on the back bench. On the Sunday and the following Monday, armed with that information she got from talking to Fairhall, she rang him in Newcastle and told him that he must come to Canberra immediately in order to thwart McMahon. Ainslie then proceeded to work with a small group, to which Malcolm Fraser briefly belonged, on Gorton's campaign, where her role was to contact and recruit some of the newer members of Parliament. Her list included Edward St John, who voted for Gorton in the leadership contest and became the first MP to demand his resignation. How important then was Ainslie Gotto in the leadership outcome? Gordon Freeth, who voted for Hasluck in the leadership contest, later said, quote, it was probably due to her efforts more than most others that Gorton became Prime Minister. Clyde Cameron, a Labour backbencher in 1968, told Gorton in 1984, and this was in the course of a series of conversations which has produced three large volumes of transcript between the two men, he told Gorton that it's accepted by all of those who saw what was happening that she had just as much influence, perhaps more than some, in canvassing or winning support for your Prime Ministership. Gorton did not think that Ainslie had obtained a lot of support, but certainly had secured some in places around Australia outside of Victoria. At the very least, to anyone who was observing Liberal Party politics in 1967 and early in 1968, it was evident that the young lady that Irwin called my little girl wasn't just a secretary. Her appointment as PPS in 1968 was controversial, but it should not have been surprising. Bunting tried, before his departure from the Prime Minister's department, to save the incumbent PPS. Peter Bailey, a Rhodes Scholar, an Oxford graduate, and a First Assistant Secretary of the Prime Minister's department, met all of Bunting's criteria and was perfect for the job. A mature age, educated male who was above all a department man. Bunting told Gordon that what he needed at his elbow was, quote, an official of experience, of grasp of the machine, and of all-round quality. It was a very good argument, but wasted entirely on Gordon. He neither needed nor wanted an official he saw as by, for, and of the public service. Settling quickly into her job, Ainslie won an early power struggle with Lennox Hewitt, Bunting's controversial replacement as Secretary of the Prime Minister's Department. The initial issue was control of information. Hewitt believed that all papers and letters intended for the Prime Minister should pass through his office. Ainslie argued that to advise the Prime Minister to look for potential political problems and to raise red flags, she needed to see all cabinet documents and have access to all communications from state premiers. Hewitt tried to stop her, but within weeks of taking the job, Ainslie had won her battle. The Prime Minister wanted his PPS to have access to everything directed to him. Within 2 years of becoming Gordon's PPS, Ainslie had established herself as something else, as his principal confidant. A role Betty Gordon had occupied since her husband in the 1930s. One evidence of the change taking place was the official visit to Washington, a disastrous trip, in mid-1968. A frustrated Gordon sat alone with Ainslie for a succession of late-night conversations at Blair House, where an unhappy Prime Minister released his feelings about President Johnson and the Vietnam War. As PPS, Ainslie made herself indispensable, contributing to the day-to-day and overall management of government by keeping an often erratic Gordon focused, by protecting him from intrusions and distractions, and by being a frank and loyal confidant, and doing so in an atmosphere where disloyalty and duplicity had become commonplace. And while doing the job, Ainslie changed it to one more akin to the present Chief of Staff. Initially, she was criticised on two counts. She was young and she was female. A female appointment might have been acceptable, but a female who could be spoken of as a girl, a mere girl, or just a girl, or worst of all, an attractive girl, was not. John McClay, a conservative liberal, one of Ainslie's good friends in the party room, and a strong Gordon supporter, later described her appointment as a mistake. The Prime Minister, he said, should have employed, and here I'm quoting, some old bag with thick lenses and big hips. Over time, the criticisms of Ainslie took three main forms, and if you listen to them carefully, they might remind you of some criticisms made in 2013-14 to another Chief of Staff. First, she failed to respect men of importance. That is, she addressed them, in her case the problem, addressed them by their first names. David Fairbairn, the Minister for National Development, said Ainslie tried it with him once, and he pulled her up. He told Ainslie, quote, I am always known as Mr. Fairbairn, though presumably not by his wife Ruth, for whom he was, of course, a spear thrower carrier. Ainslie did not ever recall addressing Fairbairn by his first name and claimed that she only used first names when invited to do so. She also insisted that she always addressed Gordon as Mr. Gordon or Prime Minister in public. I suspect there were occasional slip-ups or situations where the line between the public and the private was broad. Bird. And Ainslie could be perverse. Labour's Clyde Cameron claimed that Ainslie always kept her distance from him. He could never address him as Clyde. It was always Mr. Cameron. Secondly, Ainslie was accused of blocking access to the Prime Minister. The charge was accurate enough. The job required her to stem the flow of traffic into the pre-Prime Minister's office. Ainslie did what chief executives, bishops and vice-chancellors, among others, expect of their secretaries. In Gorton's case, it was a bit more than that. There were certain ministers he was very anxious to keep out. And Mrs Fairbairn, always found it hard to get in. He always seemed to be in need of reassurance. If a much older woman had told senior ministers and long-serving backbenchers that the Prime Minister was unavailable, they might have shrugged their shoulders or sat down to wait their turn. Receiving the same message from someone Fairbairn called a young girl and possibly delivered in a sharp manner would have not been received with equanimity or resignation. Thirdly, Ainslie was accused of exercising too much influence over the Prime Minister, and particularly in relation to appointments. Irwin's infamous explanation for his dumping from the Gorton ministry, "It wiggles, it's shapely, and its name is Ainslie Gotto," was treated as evidence of that influence. Ainslie told me that Gorton discussed every important decision he made, appointment decision he made, with her, with one exception. She was dumbfounded by Irwin's elevation. The first she heard of it was on the radio. If asked, she would not have recommended him. I quote, "Anyone else would have been better. I'd worked with the man for years, and I knew how incompetent he was, and I wasn't shy of saying that." But Gorton didn't tell her because he knew that she would have erupted. The Prime Minister's original decision and promise as early as March 1968 to promote Andrew Peacock was overturned following a conversation with Ainslie Gotto. The newly appointed PPS warned him that Peacock was, quote, "a player and inherently lazy," whereas Philip Lynch was a hard worker. And she also made the point Lynch was a Catholic, and no Catholic had sat in the ministry since 1963. Peacock, I might point out, remained on the back bench until after the 1969 election. John Gorton told Clyde Cameron in 1964 that a private secretary could only have a limited influence over him. You might ask them what they thought about something, but very rarely. I don't think you'd be swayed by what they thought, except as another example of thinking. Clearly, Gorton was keen to stress that he made his own decisions and that he did not need contributions from anyone else. Yet even supposing it was rare for Gorton to ask Ainslie for her thoughts on an issue, it would have been a rarer moment if she did not offer an opinion. Critics within the Liberal Party never followed up rumours about the Gorton-Gotto relationship that it might have had a sexual dimension. Clyde Cameron was not going to be backward. He raised the question directly with Gorton in 1984. He quoted Ainslie's comment to Women's Day in March of 1975 that she admired you excessively and had a tremendous affection for you. Gorton agreed that she had an affection for him, and he had an affection for her, a very strong one. Gorton spoke as someone experienced in extramarital relations. "I was in love with my wife, but I don't say exclusive love. He and Betty had been married for more than 40 years, and Gorton said that the first flush of love generally goes in about 5 years at the outside. While admitting that he had very strong feelings for Ainslie, Gorton said people might consider that I was also very fond of my wife. Ainslie Gotto and John Gorton evidently did have strong feelings for each other. But before speculating about a physical relationship, it is well to remember that no one close to them at the time thought remotely that they were engaged in one. They denied in interviews having one, and that each at the same time had their own romantic preoccupations. John Gordon resigned and was replaced by McMahon in March 1971 after the Liberal Party divided 33-all on a confidence motion triggered by Fraser's decision to leave the government. Ainslie remained with Gordon when he became Minister for Defence and stayed with him after McMahon removed him from office. In 1972, she was headhunted to work as an executive assistant to the Canadian millionaire Bill Pollock, who owned Drake International, the world's third largest employment agency. Within 3 months of moving to Monaco, she sent Pollock a memo judging him by implication against John Gordon as an employer. That is, unlike Pollock, Gordon listened, took notice of her opinions and took her seriously, treated her with respect for her mind and for what she could contribute, and let her have a go on her own. Ainslie, in making those comments, did not think it at all relevant that she had entered the business world for which she had no background, training or expertise, other than 6 months spent as a secretary typist for a Canberra furniture and removals company. Although she advanced to be a director of 6 Drake companies, Ainslie never felt comfortable in a place where the word dialogue was used as a verb. In 1978, she left Drake for a trial marriage with Rick Moran, a Canadian who made his millions selling hamburgers and whom she met in Monaco through Pollock. She regarded Moran as the great love of her life, but the trial marriage that she set upon lasted just 2 years. The post-Gordon years, Ainslie called them her afterlife, did give her access in both hemispheres to the rich, the powerful, the titled, and the very interesting. Careers in the media, in politics, and in business all seemed to be open for her. Yet because Gordon had let Ainslie assume that for her anything and everything was possible, she believed that her unique qualifications were sufficient to secure and sustain employment in every field she attempted to enter. Having sacrificed a normal life of normal living, by working for Gordon and later Drake, and Drake was even worse than Gordon, Ainslie was unwilling to spend time acquiring the skills necessary for the positions she sought. And as a result, she never found anything to replicate the excitement and satisfaction she experienced in working for Gordon. But that said, she did have a glamorous lifestyle. She might attend the Cannes Film Festival or the Monaco Grand Prix, sail around the Virgin Islands in one of Moran's yachts, dine at private clubs in London, spend weekends in the country estates of the English aristocracy, or introduce a male friend to the Great Barrier Reef or Lizard Island. From 1979 to the mid-1980s, she lived in a 5-storey house in London's fashionable Belgravia, which Moran had bought from the Hollywood star Tony Curtis. There she hosted dinners either prepared by a butler or delivered by outside caterers. The Great and the Good sat amid tasteful surroundings which included original paintings, antique furnishings and exquisite objets d'art. Ainslie's hairdresser in those days was the preferred choice of some of the royals. She bought expensive jewellery from a celebrated designer in Piccadilly Arcade. Ainslie discovered Jasper Conran when he was just 19 and became one of his early private customers when he was still affordable. She bought her antiques from a third-generation family company in London. She was pursued in this period by a besotted Hollywood film mogul and by an even more besotted, self-styled Grand Inquisitor of British television, Sir Robin Day. Several American multimillionaires and 2 German jet-setters participated in the hunt. In 1984, Women's Weekly article described Ainslie as, quote, still very attractive, with her striking dark good looks and freckled elfin face, her mind as sharp and energy as sharp as ever. It relays the almost obligatory first impression of an imperious, rather brusque woman. It followed with the equally obligatory discovery that on further acquaintance, Asie was a warm-hearted, sincere person who cares passionately about everything, especially telling the truth. Behind the clipped words and no-nonsense manner, you discover a lady who is intensely shy and fanatically private. And in this period, and from the mid-1980s to the end of that decade, Australian and English publishers kept giving her contract, offering her contracts. Harry M. Miller had already signed her up as a client. And Ainsley entered negotiations in the United States, Britain and Australia to make television programs and to supply videos to the Australian market. Australian magazines could still treat her as a celebrity for more than two decades of her afterlife. They were present when she set herself up on the Gold Coast, where she established her own interior design company, Ainsley Gotto International, and acquired a boyfriend and a rural retreat in the Gold Coast hinterland. In 1993, she married Nick Carson, a prominent Sydney solicitor, and settled for an eastern suburbs lifestyle. Many black tie dinners with the legal fraternity, and parties at the Royal Sydney Golf Club, trips to rural properties and racetracks, visits to art galleries, concerts and the theatre, as well as travel to the United Kingdom, to France and the United States. Ainsley became a leading figure in the national and international version of Women Chiefs of Enterprise. She was, in John Howard's words, a great networker for the Liberal Party. She was central to the planning and execution of three celebrations of Gordon's life, two birthday parties and a biography, and finished her working life as Chief of Staff for a shadow minister, Senator Helen Coon. Unfortunately, there was a sadder and often more dominant side to Ainsley's afterlife. Several attempts to enter the film and television industry never got off the ground, partly because Ainsley was not prepared to do the work. She was sacked from one television company in England, Granada, because her voice was considered too posh for the audience of Northwest England. Her interior design company went bankrupt, and her husband sold the rural retreat in her absence in order to save his money, which was needed to maintain it. All three of Ainsley's longer-term relationships, including her marriage to Carson, ended in hurt and, in one two cases, acrimony. Ainsley's four-year fight for what she saw as justice in the financial settlement of her divorce, cost her in the region of $500,000 to obtain a result in the family court, which was actually available at the start of her campaign. Ainsley's father was right. His second daughter was hopeless with money. She was a spender and thought nothing of going further and further into debt. Many of her friends thought she'd led an unhappy life, starting with her dysfunctional family, her parents' divorce in 1972, the death by car accident in the same year of her younger sister, and also what became a toxic relationship with her older sister. Race Matthews thought that the young woman he met at the end of the 1960s, quote, had never been wrapped in love. Perhaps one of her saddest messages was the one she wrote her father in 1990. I quote, "We are ultimately alone, whether we like it or not." Yet for all that went wrong in her afterlife, Ainsley's one real disappointment was that her obsession with privacy meant that few people knew what she had achieved in the Gordon years, that she was someone of power and influence. My task, I suspect, was to rectify the deficiency, though it was never put to me that way.
Many thanks to Ian Hancock. I should clarify, I looked at the flyer and that was a reference to Jim Plimsoll, but it's by Jeremy Hardiner. So there we are. So many thanks for that. We've got copies of Ainsley Gotto by Ian Hancock available. I'm sure the author would be happy to sign one tonight. So thanks for a great talk. Just come back. you make the point in your book, and you make the point tonight, that Ainsley Gatto was a very private person. I should say, I think she gave the only public speech she ever gave to the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the launch of your book on John Gordon. So she was a very private person. On the other hand, in death, she's not a private person, because she's obviously left a lot of material which you've used about her personal life and her business life and her life beyond politics. So how do you explain the very private woman in life who's probably left more personal papers about her personal life than virtually anyone else that we know of?
I think that's certainly true, although she's put all sorts of restrictions on who can actually get to those. I'm a man with enormous power. I can say whether you can have them or not. In my view, as an historian, just go for it. The reason that a lot of that material, and there are 90-odd boxes of material of Ainsley's in the library. I mean, I'm writing a book about Josiah Simon, who was a Commonwealth Attorney General, leading lawyer in South Australia, owned a vineyard, did so many things. He lit only 53 boxes, fairly trivial. 90-odd boxes of her mother's papers as well, including possibly frightful material about Jehovah's Witnesses and so on. But the reason she did so is that when I started working with her on Gordon way back in 2001, 2002, she said to me, and I didn't see any of these records, I've got all these boxes, what should I do with them? And I said, well, I think the obvious thing to do is Gordon's papers are in the National Library. I think you should just hand them over. I thought of 5, 6, 7, or 8 boxes. And she said, well, should I put some people I love letters, should I put them in? I said, most certainly. I want to see them, but more importantly, people need to know. And you don't destroy anything. You let the library decide what should be kept. You put it in there. And that's how she did it. I don't think she really thought of anyone sitting there reading it, because all of this time, until 2016, I would say to her jokingly, I'd start another biography, and she was always involved in whatever I did. I'm going to write about you one day. She said, no, you're not. I said, I will. I promise you I will. And she said, no one's going to do that. And I met her very sadly. It was on the day of the launch of Tom Hughes' book. She was clearly in pain, and she was clearly very upset. I didn't understand the extent. I knew she'd had cancer before, but I thought she'd got over it. And she just said to me, you can write the book. It wasn't the right time to say, I'm not going to do it. I didn't have much choice. I think she didn't really have any idea of what was going to come out. And I think I'd have to say this, that if she had lived, I very much doubt if this book would be here, because knowing her when I was doing Gordon and how much she fought over every sentence, the word "and" always got through, but not too many others, it would have been a tough fight. And I might well have had to say, look, I'm not going to publish this book. I'll put it in the National Library as a manuscript, and it'll be available after our death, and that'll be it. That's what I expect would have happened had she lived, because it would have been a tough fight. So she was not happy about releasing material, but she had no idea what was coming.
I think you said before that she left 2 files titled love letters.
Yes. Boxes.
2 boxes of love letters. Anne.
Yeah, it's great that you've done, and she's a fascinating personality. But I want to flip the criticism of her role as the principal private secretary for John Gordon, Prime Minister. It's not that she was young, that she was pretty and female so much. Would a male who was good looking and in his mid-20s have been equally criticised for having that position? Now, I do understand that it's difficult times because we hadn't had the development of a prime ministerial office, but it seems to me that with all the sexism and everything else taken away, you've still got the problem of her having literally no proper qualifications and being given charge of the prime minister's office. I don't think a young man of 20 would have got that job.
No, I take your point, and I think the key always with a male is a mature male. No, that was the thing that Bunting was the one who basically set out the criteria for someone who should be like that. And remember, he knocked back when Holt wanted to appoint somebody who'd been a very important person in Treasury. That Bunting was absolute no, because Treasury and Prime Minister had been fighting each other since Federation, or close to it, and he thought that would be a person would not be loyal. So if a male aged 25 or 22 might have had an outside chance, but Bunting would have said, not mature enough.
Thank you.
I think that was the thing that really kept coming back. Everyone who spoke about it, the person they wanted, mature male, was a very frequent phrase.
But Bunting approved and got her in the end?
No, not really. I mean, he had to get on with her, and they did. And they certainly... Of course, being Canberra in 1964, her family knew Bunting's family. They all knew each other. And she knew... One thing she knew very much clearly about was that everybody was very upset that he got kicked out of Prime Minister's, made all the more upset when the bête noire of the public service, Lennox Hewitt, was given the job. So there was a sympathy for Bunting, but no, I think...
She certainly wasn't alone in this, but you mentioned she didn't like McMahon and Fraser. Mm. What were the... Was there more than the... when Fraser resigned from Gordon's ministry, was there something further in that?
I didn't like him when he thought he was... she was just a whip, she thought he was aloof, not friendly, inclined to speak down to her. So she started with a dislike. In the book, I quoted a good example of privacy. When she was retired and she wrote these articles for Women's Day, she then insisted on looking over them because the contract entitled. She knocked out an awful lot of material, which gave stuff away. And one part that gave away was that she'd, on the tape it said, "I can't stand Michael. He made a pass at me when drunk one night. Ugh." That was the response. Now, had that been sort of put out in public, this might have been something that people remembered much later, over trousers.
Right, so,
Just to throw forward to the current, how do you think Ainsley would have coped with today's environment in Canberra and the style of both administration and politics?
She would have been absolutely appalled. She, it's ironic in a way because she didn't like Peter Crittenden, for example, at all, didn't like what she did, but Ainsley was heading much in that direction, except that she was operating with a staff of 13 in the Prime Minister's department. Crittenden had a staff of over 40, and she was broadly across government, so it was a far more... Now, she would have found that appalling. She'd have found disloyalty appalling, because she'd experienced it firsthand with Gordon, and she'd see that again. She was a very strong supporter of Malcolm Turnbull, so I don't think she would have liked... she didn't have much time for Abbott, I remember. She had lots of soundings off about that. No, I think she'd have found it a mess. And that was one of the things that she, when she was working for Helen Coonan's office, she behaved there like she was back in the late 1960s. Now, what this meant, what she didn't really grasp, I think, is that her colleagues in the staff didn't like it at all. Some of them, two of them, refused to be in the same room. And one of them wanted to take on an harassment case before the courts. I mean, because she just behaved as she would have back then and got away with it. Finding she couldn't get away with it, she'd have hated it. But fortunately, in the shadow minister's office, she couldn't do much damage.
Ellen?
You touch on, and you have touched on, the intriguing fact that Ainsley, as John Gorton's closest confidant, was having a relationship with her counterparty in the Labor Party. Mm. He also, just as a matter of fact, threw in the prime ministerial infidelity as something that was encountered. How commonplace do you think knowledge of either of those relationships was at the time? And did it have any impact on the way things unfolded in the Gordon years?
I think probably fair to say that in politics back then, what it was like a football field. What's on the field stays on the field. You don't talk about it when you get off. Well, in politics, you don't talk about things like that because that's not central to the field of politics. They wouldn't have bothered. I asked Laurie Oakes how much was known about Matthews, and she said, not really. But it was on for over a year. She had a relationship for 6 months, which was never been published at all, with a backbench Liberal MP in 1968. Never. I've heard no whispers of it at all. I asked Laurie Oakes about it. No, didn't know. Didn't hear about it. It was just left to one side. They were very discreet, and of course there weren't doorstop things. There weren't television. There were cameras everywhere. There was no street lighting.
Milton.
Gorton's prime ministership began to unravel later on this night after the press gallery dinner and the late night visit to the American ambassador's home. Because that's what Ted Singer picked up and made a big issue of. What role, if any, did Ainsley play in that? Because I think she wasn't present in the car, as I recall, it was Tony Eagleton who accompanied, him on that night in the car journey and Geraldine Willisie. Was she involved in any way?
Well, she was at the American Embassy. She was then attached to the ambassador's chief of staff. She liked chiefs of staff. They were dancing and singing. It's important to understand the background of that. The American ambassador had walked, you know, the geography, walked across the lawn to the lodge to tell him about the decision about renewing bombing. Gorton was furious because, A, he hadn't sought an appointment, he thought he could just walk in, and B, that we were not told in advance that this was going to happen. So Gorton was in a bad mood from that day. And the American ambassador thought he'd solved the problem by inviting Gorton to the embassy for a drink later, where people were having a party. Remember, that was the night of a press gallery dinner, and that's where Geraldine Willisie was and Gorton was. And Ainsley, at the behest of the ambassador, rang Tony Eagleton, who was at the press gallery, and said, could you bring Gorton with you? He's getting very insistent. She made the call a second time. And finally, Eagleton persuaded Gorton to go off there. Ainsley had no idea. She had an idea that Gorton at a press gallery dinner for a long time would not be entirely sober on arrival. But when she walked through the door, he walked through the door with Willisie holding his arm. That was his intent. She realised she'd made a terrible mistake, and she said to me he was very, very drunk. Her task from that point was to try and persuade Gorton to go home. She stood at the other side of the room and kept going over there. In fact, at one stage, to quote her, what he said, piss off, Ainsley, we don't want you here, while he was talking to Willisie. He had no influence at all on the moment, had no influence on all getting rid of him. It was Eagleton who got him out. It was a disaster.
Lindsay.
Did she ever have political ambitions herself?
Yes, she did. She was asked several times. The first time she was actually asked in 1968, would she stand for the seat of Canberra? And she didn't want to do that. She didn't think that was a big enough effort. She was constantly approached. But the most important moment for her was when Eagleton became federal director. Eagleton was very close to her because he was press secretary when she was PPS. She raised with him the possibility that because the seat of Dobie's seat of Cook, that's right, because that seat had changed hands a couple of times, she got into her head that with her public persona, she might be able to turn it into a safe Liberal seat. And she asked Eagleton what he thought. And he very neatly defected and said, look, why don't you get in touch with the director of elections in New South Wales, Peter Solomon, and talk to him. She went to see him. She flew out to Australia to see him and came with 17 questions about what was involved in this particular exercise. The 17 questions should have told Solomon straight off that she didn't have a clue about Liberal Party politics or indeed pre-selection procedures. She was finding out what to do. She didn't know anything at all about the way the Liberal Party approached pre-selections and had no idea of the feelings inside. She'd heard someone say that Dobie wasn't popular, he'd lost the seat, he'd just got it back, he wouldn't be any use. In fact, Dobie had the division basically sewn up. There was no chance of her doing it. And it was pointed out to her, well, if you go to sit in Monaco, you want to challenge pre-selection, you're not in a strong position. You need to be out here for at least 12 months. That was the end of that. But she did think about it very seriously, enough to go that far. But that was the end of it.
Which raises a question about her political judgment, because I think in your book, you say that after Gorton had to step down as leader, she proposed setting up a John Gorton party, which she thought would take over from the mainstream Liberal Party, which was a very, I mean, they were difficult times, but this was a huge political miscalculation, showed bad judgment.
Yeah, I think so.
So, tell us about, it seemed from looking at your book that the one very close relationship he had was with Race Matthews, who I think he wanted to marry her, and she probably didn't want to marry him at that stage. So, what was that? What was so, that seemed, that relationship seemed to last a long time beyond the early times, well, in an emotional sense.
Unlike all her other relationships, it survived a breakup. In other words, she remained, she managed to, people always talk about we must become friends. Well, they did, but they became friends, very intimate friends, and talked. I mean, he came, flew up from Melbourne a couple of times, I think. I remember running into her once, went to visit her when she was dying. He was always there to help. And Iola, his wife, has also been always there to help. It's been it's one of the better parts of her last time alive. She ran out of friends towards the end.
And I think one of the reasons why she gave for not wanting to marry Matthews, Race Matthews at that time, was that apparently she didn't want to have children.
Yeah.
But that wasn't a long-time attitude to children, was it?
No, she had an operation, I think it's mentioned in the book, one stage to see if she could have children, because there was some doubt about it, and she was found that she could, but it wasn't much use telling the boyfriend that, because he didn't want any. And that was another sort of source of problem. No, she wants to have children. And one thing I can say about it, what I've seen of her and what other people tell me who have got children, she was terrific with children. She'd get on the floor with them. It was very easy because she's much closer to it than the rest of us. But she'd be kind of walking around with hands and knees and the lot. She loved children. Very good with them. Children and dogs. The adults were a problem.
So finally, there's one question down there. Just take that and then...
Ian, I got to know Ainslie in the latter years of her life, having moved to the building in which she resided, Mount Stuart in Edgecote. And over those 7 years, we became very close friends. It coincided with the building lobbying the Willara Council against the development of the front.
Yes.
And that was part of a global army team which she sort of led. Became even closer in terms of that joint effort. And at one stage, I remember her clearly saying, just a few years before she passed away, that, John, I must remind you, I'm not just a lobbyist. She said, I ran the bloody country. I think she said in the States. And I don't know if you can recall what year or period that was, coinciding with.
Well, no, she was always with him when he went overseas, except the only time she wasn't was when he went to Vietnam. And he explained in a press conference that Ainslie couldn't go with him because he couldn't face her mother if she died. So she kept her out of a war zone. But as far as I'm aware, she was with him wherever he went.
So in conclusion, what do you hope your book has achieved? Because she was a... Her name was known.
Yes.
Some of us knew her. We knew her at the Sydney Institute, but we didn't know this sort of stuff. So what do you think, what do you hope you
will
achieve?
Well, I hope that people realise that Peter Credlin wasn't the first. That she was preceded by 50 years. I just think it's important that people see that this young woman, without much of an education, was able to get that far by actually putting her head down and working very hard. She didn't do it after she left Gordon and Drake. And that she was able to, and this is what she always talked about, why she had a most terrible night with Gordon at a dinner party here in Sydney with Jermaine Greer. And they did not hit off at all. And she made the mistake of saying to Greer, I don't understand what this women's liberation was about. And Greer took the view that, well, if I had to explain it to you, you'd be lost anyway, so I won't bother. And it was a very... But she always said, and it was a strange argument, that what people should judge is performance, not the grounds of birth, identity, whatever happens. It's what you do when you get there. And I think you could reasonably argue that although she probably shouldn't have got the job, she got it. And she did it. and that she performed. And she met her own criteria that you judge people by their performance, not by their identity, their birth, their background or whatever, but what they do. And she always felt that she did it.
About John, to paraphrase what I said about John Gordon, she did it her way. That's what you're saying. Look, thanks for a terrific performance tonight and for an important book about an important Australian woman. So Ainsley Gatto by Ian Hancock, we've got for sale tonight, and I'm sure the author will be happy to sign them. But I know you're very productive, and I know there will be more books, and you mentioned one of them tonight, but we're always very pleased to have you here because you communicate so clearly. You're on top of your facts and your opinions are always measured and considered. Well done on this, and I hope it goes well. Congratulations.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.